I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
On this week's Trade Guys, Bill and I have a conversation about forced labor and the effectiveness of excluding from the U.S. market goods from China. We also will talk about the trade agenda in the Western Hemisphere and an interesting case of countervailing duties in the chemical business.
Trade Guys, good to be back. I think pollen season struck back at Andrew with full force. Myself, I'm doing okay for now, though you never know when it's going to act up again. Guys, let's begin with what looks like a disappointing result for the United States and its values. Xinjiang's textiles seem to be doing great, despite the United States' Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, or UFLPA, sanctions. So, Trade Guys, can you remind us about UFLPA and whether or not it's been effective so far, given the latest data?
Well, UFLPA was the combined efforts of a lot of forces to try to insert American values about forced labor, particularly the situation for the Uyghurs in this particular part of China. It's been a priority for a number of elected officials, both in the administration and in Congress. It's always been a challenge, but it represented some new tools. It was a much more aggressive approach to these sorts of exclusion orders by the Customs and Border Protection. It also operates on sort of a reversal in the burden of proof. In most cases where a good is suspected of being produced with forced labor or child labor or prison labor or something like that, where there's a prohibition in U.S. law, there's usually a knowing standard on the part of the importer. In this case, imports are excluded unless the importer can prove that there is not a problem. So it's a fairly aggressive approach. Unfortunately, at least members of Congress and China Commission and other bodies are unhappy with the results. I certainly support the aims of UFLPA. The United States has excluded forced labor, well, excluded prison labor since the McKinley Tariff Act of 1896. And these provisions on forced labor actually go back to the Trade Act of 1930, Smoot-Hawley. So they've been a part of U.S. law for a while. This was a more aggressive, more ambitious approach to excluding these in order to change the behaviors of China with regard to forced labor. By and large, it looks like it's not working because the growth in exports, the growth in production and capability from that region seems to be increasing. To me, it goes back to before Bill and I worked together at CSIS and before we were the Trade Guys, we worked together at a trade association called the National Foreign Trade Council. Bill was the president. My company was a member. And there was a project on sanctions reform. And we relied on research from Gary Huffbauer and Kimberly Elliott on the effectiveness of sanctions. They published a book. I think the subtitle was Feeling Good versus Doing Good. In a lot of cases, sanctions make you feel good, but they don't particularly do good. In that economic sanctions, they seldom achieve a policy change on the part of the target. And the conclusion by Huffbauer and Elliott, which is still the conclusion today, is they often harm people or groups that were not intended for harm. Sometimes it's the people who have the least stake in the operation or the you least want to harm. But in any case, this is one of these situations where almost without regard to what measures the United States or another party may take to exclude these materials, there's just a lot of other customers. In the consumer products business, we used to look at what was called an addressable market. In this case, what's the addressable market for products made from cotton grown in this region or apparel produced in this region? The answer is very large. The addressable market would be all of the domestic China home market, plus the other than U.S. export market. What remains in terms of The U.S. is a big importer, but what remains is not big enough to materially change the behavior. So I think we're looking at a situation where members are frustrated. They'd like to do something. The industry supports them. The National Council of Textile Organizations, called NCTO, is also in support. And that's not surprising. Go back to the original language in the Trade Act of 1930. And forced labor was considered one of the conditions of unfair trade. But at the old days, it required an industry petition for the government to act. In this case, the government acts on its own. Having said all that, and however much we were repulsed by the idea of forced labor, doesn't look to me like we're going to have much luck in changing the behavior. And I just think that's the reality of overall effectiveness of sanctions and how much of the Chinese total market of both cotton and apparel from this region can actually be affected by U.S. policy.
Well, for those of you that follow this issue closely, we're going to have a treat coming up in a few weeks. The Trade Guys have a guru on Ovalpah, and his name is John Foote, who's a partner at Kelly Dry and Warren, the law firm where I used to have a seat. He's been on before, and we're going to have him back to bring everybody up to date on the latest. And it's taken some interesting turns, and he was kind enough to supply me with a couple of data points. To date, meaning last week, there have been 8,142 detentions, meaning imports coming in, boxes, packages, whatever, coming in have been detained. Of those, the CBP, the Customs and Border Protection authorities, have decided what to do with 82.6% of them. So there's some where they haven't decided what to do yet. Because you'll recall what happens is that they're detained, and the burden of proof is on the importer, as Scott said, to prove that the material was not made with forced labor or did not come from Xinjiang. And the thing sits in custody until the fact of that is established. So there's some cases where they haven't made a decision yet. But what has fascinated me about this, and this has been true, I think, almost from the beginning of enforcing the statute, which is only a couple of years, is that of those cases where there has been a decision about detention, 51.5% of the detentions have been released. That means CBP decided basically either that they made a mistake or that the importer was able to prove that the item in question did not come from Xinjiang or did not have Xinjiang cotton in the case of textiles in it. That's a rather high number. So more than half actually are being released, which may be one reason for the larger data point about imports growing. It's also a little bit of a surprise because when the act was passed and the burden was shifted, there was a lot of speculation that this would essentially put a stop to all imports because of the impossibility of proving you're innocent, particularly when the Chinese were clear at the time in their refusal to cooperate with efforts to certify or identify the source of their products. That turned out not to be the way it's played out. It's played out in a much more, I think, even-handed way. In addition, the other interesting thing that's happened is proving, as is axiomatic in the sanctions world, a misapplication of Newtonian physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And every time the United States government does something, it creates an incentive for the other side to do something to get around what we've done. In this case, a pair of textile companies in particular have taken on both 5G and AI in order to reduce their energy costs and improve their productivity to make their products even more competitive. That's probably not helped them that much with the U.S. market because there's still the Ovalpah test, but I think it's helped them globally. And a lot of what happened in the early days, particularly with textiles, was companies, Chinese exporters, essentially creating two markets. One market that was Xinjiang cotton free for the U.S. and one market that wasn't for everybody else that didn't have a law. So, you know, the market responds in these situations. And so if you wanted to have 100% of Chinese imports detained because of this, you're probably disappointed. But it also, I think, is encouraging in the sense that it appears that CBP is taking its job seriously and is actually investigating these things one by one and is willing to acknowledge proof when it's provided and let the shipment in. So we'll have John with us in a few weeks to bring us more up to date on that. It has clearly, and I think he will tell you this, clearly been a pain for companies that are trying to comply with the rules and trying to trace their supply chains back as far upstream as they can to demonstrate no Xinjiang or forced labor content. But, you know, as with everything, things settle down, people stop complaining, they figure out what to do about it, and there's a new equilibrium. And we seem to be moving into that situation right now.
A few weeks ago, we discussed a conversation around rethinking the de minimis threshold. How does that play into FOPA considerations?
Well, Congress did something about that. The Ways and Means Committee, anyway, not all of Congress. The Ways and Means Committee approved a bill that removed de minimis treatment for items from China that were subject to exceptional tariffs, i.e. not regular most favored nation tariffs, but items that were subject to the Trump tariffs, the Section 301 tariffs, which I think right now is about half of Chinese imports, or items that were subject to anti-dumping or countervailing duty tariffs, or to the steel and aluminum tariffs that Trump imposed. So if you're in those categories, you don't get de minimis anymore. Now, at one level, that doesn't make a huge amount of difference. We weren't shipping in a lot of steel through the de minimis system because it's heavy. It doesn't lend itself well to, you know, UPS packages. But in other cases, I think that cutting some Chinese stuff out of de minimis is going to have an impact. The bill that was approved did not go as far as Democrats wanted, what most Democrats wanted, which was to remove China from de minimis entirely. And it didn't do that. This is sort of a partial remedy, but it's also got a long way to go. It has to make it through the House floor. It has to make it through the Senate. I'm skeptical, at least before the election, that will happen, but we'll see. But it is a recognition, I think, at least at the committee level, that this is a problem that they think needs to be dealt with. And so I think you're going to see continuing conversation about it. And it wouldn't surprise me completely if after the election, something springs loose and gets enacted.
This is one where I think it's important for Congress to be careful, because there were reasons to raise the de minimis level in the first place, including important issues like risk management, like customs and border protection, and a better focus on large shipments to better manage what's a very difficult job in the first place. And in this case, my sense is there's a confluence of interests. In other words, people who are concerned, people in groups who are concerned about imports from this region are also would like to get rid of de minimis altogether or don't like de minimis as a whole. So that doesn't mean that de minimis is causing shipments of material that would otherwise be excluded from arriving in the United States. So I think I liked the Ways and Means Republican proposal, which was at least criteria-based, that it kept some of what higher de minimis benefits the economy and particularly benefits small shippers who need to handle returns and things like that. It does have its benefits and probably ought not to be thrown out completely. But it's one of those where it will be easy to blame de minimis. But as I said at the outset, I think the issue here is China has a gigantic home market, a domestic market for cotton apparel. And it also has a lot of customers outside of China, export markets, that don't have the restrictions the U.S. market does. And those are the major factors. De minimis may be a part of the problem, and certainly the proposal that was passed out of Ways and Means would be a sensible way to address that. But it's hard to blame this whole thing on de minimis.
I don't know. I worry about you, Scott. You always support the Republican proposal. Dangerous.
This one, they happen to have a good idea here, but I would support any criteria-based proposal in this case. I do think de minimis has its benefit, and a straight line reduction to the old levels would harm a lot of people that are using it for the right reasons. The small enterprises that need to handle a return, which is a normal retail practice, and making it difficult for their foreign customers is not in the interest of these small exporters.
The other thing that's going on is there have been calls by individual members of Congress to somehow sanction the Chinese fast fashion companies, Temu and Shein, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, Shein. That hasn't happened. I mean, to the extent their products are covered by Trump tariffs, they'll be caught up in the Ways and Means Committee de minimis change. But there's an effort separate from that, I think, to further punish them. It'll be interesting to see how that evolves. I think part of this is, one, the latest chapter in an ongoing congressional search to figure out what else can we do to stick it to the Chinese. And every week there's a new proposal, and right now it's fast fashion. There is, interestingly, and maybe in a future week we'll go into greater detail, there's an environmental argument about fast fashion. These are clothes that are cheap and are designed really for wearing that season. And if they don't fall apart by the end of the season, you're probably going to throw them away because it's the next season. So there's a lot of these companies thrive on turnover. They sell cheap stuff in the expectation that you'll wear it for the next few months, and then you'll throw it away and buy something else. All that stuff you throw away ends up in landfill someplace. It poses more difficult environmental problems than you might think. There are efforts to recycle, but there are still enormous amounts that end up in landfills simply as waste. So eventually the environmentalists are going to weigh in on this issue too.
They seem to hate it when somebody is doing something that they want to do with their own money. So
we can't have that.
We've always had those groups in America. We used to call them the Puritans, or the people who promoted blue laws, or whatever it might be, Sunday closures of liquor stores. Prohibition's a long streak in American politics. It seems like the environmental movement always finds
well, but there's nothing. I don't think there's anything salacious about Chinese apparel.
Oh, no, but you know, what I'm saying is consumers probably know they're buying not durable, not high-value goods when they shop at a fast fashion outlet.
They are, and it's pronounced Shein, Bill. I can tell that you haven't been desperate to find cheap work clothes in a hot second.
I thought it was mostly women's wear. Is it men, too?
So I think they dabble in that as well. But
it's pretty, your shirt's Shein.
I think so. Maybe someone will come back to us and correct us in comments or emails.
That'll be good. I've heard different pronunciations.
It would be Shein in the original German. That's all I can say.
That's true. And there, Bill is the expert. Well, switching gears into what looks like better news to me, APEP expansion. Sounds like more countries are interested in joining the Americas Partnership for Economic Prosperity. So guys, can you tell us about the latest APEP expansion? Who's trying to join, and how does it change the nature of the partnership?
Well, it's a little bit of a mystery. Former Senator Dodd, Chris Dodd of Connecticut, who's, I think, the president's emissary or special representative for Latin America or the Western Hemisphere, had an interview, and he said that 7 additional countries have indicated interest in joining, but he didn't mention them, so it's not clear who he was talking about. 2 countries have been public about, new countries have been public about that. Argentina, with the new government, has been vocal about it, and also Paraguay has expressed its interest. The existing or older interest has been, I think, a lot of it expressed by Central America. Costa Rica really has been the leader. In fact, the next summit of the potential, actual or potential partners, APEP partners, will be in Costa Rica next year. It's moving along slowly. It's like a weaker IPEF. And for those of you that didn't think there was all that much to IPEF, then you'll know that there's probably less to APEP. A lot of talk about cooperation, some rumors which have not yet become reality that it won't even end up being an actual agreement, that it will end up being sort of a framework. That does not seem to be what's happening, but it had reached, you know, sort of that low a level a few months ago. It's going to get a boost, though, because there's new legislation in Congress that is actually quite interesting and also, I think, revealing about the congressional mood. And this is the America's Act, which has been introduced by Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, and I think Senator Bennett was, you know, there's a number of sponsors, but I think those are the two leads. It really is designed to move the hemisphere in the direction of a tighter agreement and a more formal agreement than the administration appears to be contemplating. The bill, among other things, I mean, it's 217 pages, so there's a lot in it. But among other things, it establishes a draft MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, for potential America's partner countries. And the MOU contains model standards on things like democracy, trade, rule of law. And the idea is that countries will agree to the MOU, and that makes them an America's partner. And then for the first time, not in APEP as designed, but in the bill, there actually are incentives to do that. And they're tangible benefits. This is our favorite IPEP phrase that the IPEP partners kept talking about. Where are the tangible benefits? And the answer is, in IPEP, there weren't very many. In APEP, there aren't any either. But this bill would create some, because a separate title, a separate subtitle would set up a $70 billion, that's with a B, dollar program of loans and grants to be available to companies seeking to either, meaning U.S. companies, seeking to either reshore in the United States or a friendshore industry away from China and into America's partner countries. It establishes a reshoring and nearshoring project program with tax credits for qualified reshoring and nearshoring expenses from China to the U.S. or to a partner country. It establishes a special $150 million program exactly for textile and apparel manufacturers, also grants, to help combat forced labor in the Chinese textile and apparel sector and bringing textile and apparel investment back to, again, the U.S. or partner countries. And then in kind of a novel approach, it also, and this is a sense of Congress, but it tells you where they're going, it has a sense of Congress provision that the USMCA review, which is scheduled for 2026, would be a good opportunity to begin the process of talking about a docking mechanism onto USMCA. A docking mechanism in trade means a means by which additional countries can join the original agreement. And this is a case where some countries, Costa Rica in particular, has been outspoken in wanting to join USMCA. And this bill is designed to move forward to create a mechanism for that happening. So that's a lot, you know, and it's got a lot of other provisions, including some environmental ones, as you might imagine. So it's designed to appeal to the administration. It's got a long way to go because it's only just been introduced. But what it tells me first is that Congress is actually quite interested in closer trade relations in the hemisphere and is willing, unlike the administration, you know, willing to put its money where its mouth is and actually vote funds and create programs designed to incentivize what they would like to see. Now, there's a footnote, you know, what they want to see is reshoring or nearshoring. So the idea is not just let's spend money to create new businesses in Latin America. It's let's get companies to move out of China and into Latin America. So we're trying to kill two birds with one stone here. But to me, it's an interesting example of a resurgence of congressional interest in the trade agenda generally and in trying to capture leadership over this particular part of the trade agenda.
I think you're absolutely right, Bill. And this is, regional initiatives tend to benefit when elected officials get interested in, because they have either interests, constituent interests in, or knowledge about the region. So when I saw Senator Cassidy's name on this bill, I thought that was helpful. I would note that trade with Mexico advanced with a Reagan presidency initially after the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement was concluded. And of course, President Reagan lived in Southern California most of his life and was very familiar with all sorts of relations with Mexico. Likewise, his vice president became president, George H.W. Bush. But also you had the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Lloyd Bentsen of Texas. And I think it was both those Southern presidents, or the presidents with an understanding of Mexico and the nations to the South, as well as Senator Bentsen, who provided the credibility for those initiatives to advance. And it took a while, and it had its issues, but I did think it helped. I would also note that we have a lot of free trade agreements with countries in the Western Hemisphere to the south of Mexico, a total of 10 of them, 10 countries, with high standard free trade agreements, most of them negotiated under the presidency of another Texan, George W. Bush, and concluded around 2011, I guess, when Panama was finally ratified and entered into force. So in any case, we've got at least over a decade of experience with high standard free trade agreements. There's an interesting project, whether it's a CSIS project or a congressional research project, of what's working and what's not about those comprehensive agreements. Because I do remember long conversations about apparel rules and the yarn forward rule of origin and a single rule of origin for the five countries of Central America plus Dominican Republic. So a lot of things done to encourage scale, encourage connection of supply chains. And as we go forward in this, it would be useful, I think, to analyze what worked and what didn't. And so we'd know what to do differently. But I do find it helpful when elected officials they've got skin in the game. They understand the region, their constituents do business there. I think it really does help give political ballast to these kinds of initiatives. So that, I think that's great. I do find hilarious the irony that joining NAFTA or joining USMCA, the fact that USMCA is now the belle of the ball and the free trade agreement everybody wants to join, I reflect on the fact that the last chapter of the original NAFTA in 1994 had an accession clause in it. And it was actually seriously considered by Chile, who wanted to do a free trade agreement with the United States, but didn't have negotiating authority. U.S. didn't have negotiating authority to do it. And they actually seriously considered, can we just accede to NAFTA? And it was politically toxic at the time. But things change over 20-some years, now 30 years. Well, it would have been suicide for Chile in the late 1990s, early aughts, to propose acceding to the NAFTA. Now becoming part of the USMCA is a good idea. So what goes around comes around.
Well, thanks for telling Bill he should give me more homework earlier, Scott. Much appreciated.
There's a landmark study waiting to be written there, Thibaut.
You know what? We're always looking for good ideas, and that was one of them. Our last story of the day is one that's more niche than usual for this podcast. Cornerstone Chemical Company filed anti-dumping petitions against Germany, India, Japan, the Netherlands, Qatar, and Trinidad and Tobago, and countervailing duty petitions against the same nations minus Japan, citing imports of the compound melamine as a cause of concern. Guys, at the risk of sounding ignorant here, I had to Google melamine for this portion of the episode, and I wouldn't have originally thought that this would become a Trade Guys issue, but apparently now some EU officials are turning this into a broader fight. So, guys, tell us about why you officials seem to be upset about these probes.
Well, alas, poor melamine. It's actually a very useful resin, useful product. If you have plastic dinnerware, which we have some around the house for our grandson, it's likely melamine. That's one of its key uses. Also, countertops is another familiar place. It's used in a number of building materials when you need a hard, waterproof surface. So Formica countertops, Formica is a brand name from the 60s, but the key component that makes a Formica top what it is this compound melamine. And so it has a lot of industrial uses, but it not the sort of thing you'd see rising to controversy. What I think I take out of this, and while we don't know, the idea that there's a countervailable subsidy in this, I mean, dumping cases to have their own rhythm and process through the Commerce Department of the USITC on unfairly traded goods that would be sold below cost or below home market price. The countervailing duty part is the interesting part for me because I didn't realize people were subsidizing melanin. They apparently, and we don't know exactly why they are, but I do know enough about the chemistry behind this to speculate that this product, as humble as it may be, is a carbon dioxide sink and scores pretty well if you're counting the carbon footprint of a good in its treatment. So melamine is actually the feedstock is a chemical called urea. Urea is quite common, including just as proteins degrade, is a natural product of it. But it's also produced in vast commercial quantities as a fertilizer. The way you make urea is you combine carbon dioxide and ammonia with heat and pressure. It's about that simple. And then you use the urea as the feedstock for melamine. Now, that would make the final product, commercial product, whether it's a countertop or a plastic dish, to be something that took carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, about out of above ground sources, and placed it in an object where it's captured, which would give it a different score than a product made some other way with some other chemistry. If that's what's going on, and that's the basis for the subsidy, then what you have is a climate-friendly subsidy that someone who from a country like the United States that doesn't include that in our pricing or support or subsidization would see it as countervailable. So if that's what it is, that's going to be interesting because that is the very caution that should accompany almost any move to try to make trade rules match up to the desires of the climate movement, the net zero movement, to use subsidies in producing more climate-friendly goods. I don't know if that's the case or not, but if it is, it'll be interesting to watch. And it gets us back. I think we talked last week about the need for Talmudic scholars to figure out which subsidies are going to be good and which ones are bad in the future.
I'm just a little surprised the Germans are objecting. I mean, this is an institutionalized process. They've got the laws. We've got these laws. This particular law has been, one of them has been in effect for more than 100 years. The other one, more than 120 years. It's a routinized, well-established method of trying to make sure the playing field is level and the other guys are not taking unfair advantage. So it's not anything new. And these cases get filed all the time. It's not, at least in this case, an instrument of U.S. government policy. The case was filed by a private company, which they have the right to do. And then Commerce gets to decide if it wants to take the case, which is a fairly low bar. They take most of them. And then it has a long way to go. I mean, it's nearly a year for the dumping case and probably a little less than that for the subsidy case, unless the government decides it's complicated and it needs more time. And it's got to, in order to win, you got to prove two things. You got to prove that the other guy did something bad, that he dumped or received a subsidy. But on top of that, you have to prove that you've been injured by those imports, not just injured, period, which that could be a recession or anything, but that you've been injured by reason of the imports. So it's relatively easy in this country to win on the first part, to prove dumping or subsidy. Dumping is a company thing. Companies dump. Subsidies are a government thing. The government grants the subsidies. There's a lot of that going on. It's a little bit harder. It's not horribly difficult, but it's harder to prove that you've been injured by reason of the imports. So these cases tend to fail at the very end when the International Trade Commission votes on the final determination. And there aren't very many that fail, but some do. And in addition, the debate often ends up being not over the fact of, you know, is there a subsidy or isn't there, or the fact of dumping, but over how much it is. Because the remedy, if you win, the remedy is not discretionary. The remedy prescribed by law is a tariff to offset the damage that's being done. So if the department determines that you are dumping, meaning you're selling the product, you know, 10% below its value, 10% below what it costs you to make it in the home country, then there's a 10% tariff attached. If the government concludes that you got a 25% subsidy from the government, your government, then it's a 25% tariff that gets attached. And the argument is often over the lawyers, which is always lawyers in these things, saying the petitioner's lawyer, the people who brought the case, saying, well, the dumping margin is 200%. You should have these enormous duties. And the lawyers for the respondent saying, well, no, it's not 200%. Maybe it's 1%, 2%. You know, and then the government comes out with a preliminary number, and then they fight it all over again, because no matter what number the government comes out with, both sides object. The Americans say it's too low, and the foreigners say it's too high. And then eventually there's a number. It's a little unusual for a government to protest at this early stage. And as Scott said, we're a little bit baffled, A, about why they're making such a big deal of it, because this is a fairly routine thing to happen. They do it to us. But it's also a little bit of a mystery, because they apparently argued that we are, whatever we are construing as a subsidy, is interfering with their emissions testing system, the ETS. And I just have had trouble figuring out the logic of that. And so far, we have theories. I think Scott propounded one, but we're still working on that. So stay tuned, and hopefully next week, when some people get back to us, we'll be able to tell you what's really going on here.
Yes, and there's one follow-up from last week's show where Andrew talked about the NFL draft. We don't have Andrew's report on how the Ravens did in his view, which I'm sure we'll get, but I do have a report on the audience size. There were 12.1 million people who watched the first round of the NFL player draft. So if you can call that a sporting event, that's amazing. Comparative is that the Masters tournament final round, which is the most viewed golf program every year in television, had fewer than 10 million viewers. So more people watched the NFL draft than watched the final round of the Masters.
And I have a complaint about that, because the draft ended up preempting Jeopardy that night, and I'm very upset about that.
That's right. Bill, Andrew will continue his ministry to you in terms of getting your viewing priorities straight and your sports.
No work. Jeopardy rules.
That's right. We may be too late.
My wife is a big fan.
Also too late for me. Although if you have numbers on soccer or rugby, Scott, I'm definitely a taker.
Well, they're all lower than the NFL draft, at least for the American audience.
Yeah, for the American
it's
audience.
It's a scary thing.
Well, I hope that's not the case for other audiences, but I'm biased.
Well, yes, and it's just, I think it's a reflection of the quality of the NFL product. People are interested all year round. There's 17 games. They're all played in the fall and early winter, but fans are fans, and they're interested all year round.
Soon to be 18, I'm reading.
That's correct, yeah. So that's the way it played out for Andrew. He'll have his report on
eventually
from Ravens Central
Scott,
next,
you think we're
next
have
time.
Year-round football, 52 games in a year.
I don't think there's a human body that can withstand that. But perhaps there'll be other leagues and other teams. They've reconstituted the XFL that's playing now. There's actually a team in Washington and a team in Alexandria, Virginia. So. There's an appetite for it, that's for sure.
Well, Scott, I have to say, I've been floored by your knowledge of the chemistry on the melamine conversation. You could have recreated Breaking Bad, but instead you decided to do this podcast, which is probably a better use of your time. Although less,
it's this one's legal.
Certainly a more legal use of his time. Yes,
yes. Right. Although less lucrative. Guys, thanks for another great episode. I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to the Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.